On today's edition of the Locked On Nets podcast, Josh and I are looking back at one of the best Nets seasons of all time. It's 2001 to 2002. We're going back to New Jersey. All that and more coming up on Locked On Nets.
You are Locked On Nets, your daily Brooklyn Nets podcast. Part of the Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day.
Hello and welcome into another edition of the Locked On Nets podcast. I am your host, Josh Bass. Here with me, as always, Marcus Barahal. Marcus, how are you holding up? First of all, I think everyone wants to hear an update of your life in quarantine.
It's been good, Josh. I mean, like as good as it can be. I'm trying to go out as little as possible, but still doing some form of exercise at home to not go completely insane. Definitely it's weird because it's gotten a little stale, but also I feel like now it's like sort of normalized a little bit for me at least. So it's not as bad as it was, but it's also kind of wish I could go outside. I'm a little bored, but how have you been?
I'm also a little bored, but staying somewhat busy with work, podcasting, TV, the likes. Both my roommates, or one of my roommates had left a couple weeks ago to go back home to Boston. My other left this morning to go home. So I'm now holding down the fort. I asked my parents if they'd like to see me and if I should come home. They said no. So I'm here from my Murray Hill apartment riding solo.
Wow. Have you given any consideration to texting friend of the show Gavin and maybe seeing if he wants to come over, maybe live there with you?
I haven't thought about it. On first blush, that's a very slippery slope. I feel like I would like the company though.
Yeah, but you give him an inch, he's going to take the whole mile. So.
And I feel like he'll bring his dog also.
Right, it's a tough spot.
Interesting. You have two open beds and a couch.
A lot of space for just one Josh.
Run a whole B&B. And we have our own little outside area, as you know.
Right. It's a great place.
Yeah. Yep. But that's not what we're here to talk about. We're not here to talk about New York real estate. We're here to talk about the 2001-2002 New Jersey Nets season. Marcus, why don't you set up what we're doing today?
Oh, wow. I'm very glad that you said that first, because I definitely would have said Brooklyn Nets if I had been the one to talk first. But you are correct. It is the New Jersey Nets. So this was the first season of kind of like a new era for the Nets. And the 3 years before this, they were pretty bad, 73 and 141. Over those previous three seasons, they were coming off a 26-win season the year before. Everything seemed not great. And then a couple trades in the offseason, some contributions from some young players like Kenyon Martin, Byron Scott, and the Princeton offense working some magic, and all of a sudden the Nets were in the finals. Josh, I know you were only six, but do you have any memories from this season?
I do. I mean, I think for one thing for me is that my dad was super into this Nets team, and that's really how I became a fan. I remember him he just was so in love with Jason Kidd and the style that these Nets played. And then literally the first basketball game I remember is during, and we'll get into this, during one of the playoff games in the series against the Charlotte Hornets. So I do remember the season, and this was really the one that kind of propelled me onto my Nets fandom from avid fan to podcaster, Marcus.
It's been a long transition that has paid dividends, I would say, for us, Josh.
Yep, let's hope so. Let's hope so.
It all kind of started with those two trades that I mentioned, the first of which was a three-team trade with Houston, which was basically the Nets sending out the 7 pick, Eddie Griffin. They got back the 13 pick, which they used for Richard Jefferson, and then also two other picks for Jason Collins, Brandon Armstrong. We talked about this trade a little bit in the podcast where we're looking back at past drafts, because Richard Jefferson at the 13th pick was obviously a steal. If you are someone who listens to the Book of Basketball 2.0 podcast, they just put up a redraft of the 2001 draft earlier today with Bill Simmons and Zach Lowe, and they talk about this trade and how At the time, like, Eddie Griffin had a lot of potential and, like, seemed like if he could, like, put it all together, he would develop into, like, a very, very good NBA player. But obviously, issues sort of, like, overtook that, and he was never able to reach his full potential in the NBA. And instead, the Nets wound up with Richard Jefferson, who would wind up contributing a ton to the Nets over the decade, as we also talked about in that best net bracket. If this had been like a 2000s bracket, he would have been definitely a very high seed in that. But he didn't actually contribute a ton in this season. He was kind of just sort of chipping in where needed off the bench, because the Nets were mostly led by Kidd, Kenyon Martin, Keith Van Horn, and Kerry Kittles as their main four guys, Josh.
Yeah, no, I think the point you made about Eddie Griffin was really interesting, because that trade actually took a lot of guts. Because remember, not only was he a very interesting college player, I'm just looking at his stats now, 18 and 11, averaged over four blocks a game, had some perimeter game in the sense that people were comparing him maybe to a bootleg version of a KG if everything panned out. But he was also a Seton Hall kid. And to trade away a local guy on draft night, it definitely took a lot of guts. And it was a move that panned out as Eddie Griffin obviously kind of bounced around the league. And then obviously something tragic for him when he passed away in 07. But I think, you know, very shrewd moves. Completely agree with you that I actually remembered RJ being a bigger part of this team. But when you look at the Nets the season before in the 2000-2001 campaign, I mean, I'll be curious to kind of go back in time to see what people thought of that team. Because obviously you had Kmart coming off basically his rookie season where he was the number one pick. Keith Van Horn only a few years removed from being a really lauded college player at Utah, and still a guy that was kind of putting up 17 a game or so, and definitely had some very high scoring campaigns earlier on his career before he really fell off due to injuries. And then you had a guy in Marbury who, you know, the Nets had basically gotten a season and a half prior from Minnesota, and he's coming off an all-star season, averaged 24 points a game, 8 assists, and, you know, I think in retrospect, the trade looks really good, but I'm sure even that season, the Nets could have been said to have a really bright future, but obviously this trade was really able to even change their fortunes exponentially and also really accelerate their timeline to being a really quality team that could do some damage in the NBA.
Let me tell you about one of the ultimate life hacks. It's hard to find the time to sit down to read and learn more, and when you don't have free time, you can't read or work on personal development. There's an incredible app that solves this problem, and I highly recommend it. It's called Blinkist. Blinkist is really unique, works on your phone, tablet, or web browser, and it makes the best key takeaways, the need-to-know information from thousands of nonfiction books, and it condenses all that into just 15 minutes that you can read or listen to. Successful people, like business leaders, are well known for reading a lot of books. Blinkist is made for busy people like you who want to get the main points of a book quickly so you can start using that information right away. And with its audio feature, Blinkist makes it easy to finish a book during your commute, on your lunch break, or while you exercise. 12 million people are using Blinkist right now, and it has a massive and growing library from self-help, business, health, to history books. Blinkist has the latest titles from bestseller lists, as well as the classic nonfiction titles you always meant to read but never had time to. With Blinkist, you get unlimited access to read or listen to a massive library of condensed nonfiction books, all the books you want, and all for one low price. Right now, for a limited time, Blinkist has a special offer just for our audience. Go to Blinkist.com/NBA to try it free for 7 days and save 25% off your new subscription. That's Blinkist, B-L-I-N-K-I-S-T, Blinkist.com/NBA to start your 7-day free trial and save 25% off, but only when you sign up at Blinkist.com/NBA.
Yeah, I think Marbury, like you mentioned, 24 and about 8 assists, but the Nets weren't really winning. Like I pointed out at the very top of the podcast, they were like pretty abysmal. The previous three seasons were like vaguely seen as a laughingstock until sort of Rod Thorne and Byron Scott came in 2000 and sort of steered the ship to where they were able to make these kinds of big moves like the Jason Kidd, forced to Fawn Marbury trade only a day after the three-team trade that got them Richard Jefferson. They make this trade on June 29th, 2001, and the Suns were kind of in the exact opposite position as the Nets at this point, because the Suns had made the playoffs 13 straight years coming into the 2001-2002 season, but they hadn't gotten past the second round with Jason Kidd as their main guy. He was an all-star the last few years that he was with Phoenix, but they just couldn't get out of the second round. It was kind of similar to the Clippers in the last decade with that, like, Chris Paul, Blake Griffin, DeAndre Jordan team. And at a certain point, it just kind of gets stale, and you want to break that sort of team up. And for Phoenix, Jerry Colangelo was their CEO at the time. He said he wasn't satisfied with 50 wins. People expect more than that, which I'm sure Nets fans at the time were like, yeah, we'll gladly take 50 wins. Like, they barely had 70 in the previous three seasons combined. So definitely just like, I think it was a case where Phoenix kind of got complacent with where they were, and they were like, yeah, we've made the playoffs for over a decade straight. Like, we can kind of make the playoffs with anyone at this point. So why not trade Kidd for a guy in Marbury who was younger, was scoring more, like, seemed like he was maybe on more of an upward trajectory, whereas Kidd was 28 at the time of the trade. Maybe they were trying to, like, sell him off at his highest value, but I think they definitely traded him a little bit too soon, right?
Yeah, I mean, I think so. It's also, I mean, this opens up a whole really interesting can of worms that, let's say, they hold on to Kidd, they're able to ascend a little bit, and they're obviously going to bring on Marion, or are they going to draft him in 2002-ish?
No, they had Marion. He was their, he was like one of their best guys, and that's why they wanted to bring Marbury in, because he was on that similar timeline to Sean Marion, just age-wise. Marion was 23, and Marbury was 24 at the time.
Right. So, listen, sliding doors, we could have never had Steve Nash and the 7 seconds or less Suns, and, you know, for Nash, he was obviously a solid player on Dallas, but didn't really become what he was until Phoenix. So if the Suns had kept Kidd and didn't have the opportunity for Nash to flourish alongside Marion, Amari, Joe Johnson at D'Antoni's helm, really could have the NBA could have looked a lot different. But
And actually to that point, Josh, like in 2001-2002, the season after this trade, the Suns go 36-46. They wind up with the ninth pick, which they use on Amari Stoudemire. And like, if they had kept Kidd and were a few wins better than if they had Marbury, like, they probably don't have that pick. Maybe they don't take Amari, which obviously he's like, other than Steve Nash, he's probably the face of the Suns since 2000, really. So definitely could have been a lot different. Who knows where he goes? Maybe he even like winds up with the Nets if they continue to struggle, and that's like a whole another timeline that we don't really want to get into, but you know.
Not yet.
Maybe someday. But yeah, Rod Thorne was the guy who did the trade for the Nets to get Jason Kidd. He had a quote after the trade saying, "We think Jason is the best all-around point guard in the league." Rod Thorne, I had like seen that name around, but I kind of looked into him a little bit more. He was like really involved in pretty much everything through the 80s and 90s before taking on the job with the Nets. He was the Bulls GM when they drafted MJ and was like the guy who really pushed for him and turned down like numerous trade requests for that number three pick in 1984. But then MJ, I believe, got hurt his second year in 1985. And then Thorne was fired, went on to work with the league, and then helped them oversee the creation of the Dream Team for the 92 Olympics, and then helped form the teams in 96 and 2000 as well. So he was a guy who clearly knew how to identify talent, and he took over as the Nets GM in 2000 and then was the executive of the year after this season when he pulled off these two trades. So he was obviously a huge figure in helping to turn the Nets around for this season. And Josh, he was, I believe, the last GM before Billy King. So definitely a little night and day right there.
I don't believe was he?
I think he like he kind of like handed off power, then took it back. He was like involved in the franchise though, up until 2010.
Steve Andaway was both the coach and GM.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I'm just looking now. But yeah, I mean, I think on the Rod Thorne side, like, he was one, you're right, obviously. And two, he was like, Rod Thorne was the architect of these teams and really a hero for Nets fans in the early to mid 2000s. And I think, you know, you can talk about whether some of his transactions at the end weren't kind of up to snuff, but you can't give this guy enough credit for basically taking a team that was in the doldrums and accelerating them at the kind of drop of a hat into a team that made back-to-back finals appearances and was a perennial playoff contender.
Yeah, I mean, just these two trades alone are like two of probably the best trades that the Nets have had in the last few decades, and they happened literally on consecutive days. So definitely a memorable two-day stretch from that offseason. What was that?
And the Vince Carter trade a few years after.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. That was another one that was like kind of a little bit risky at the time, right?
It was, yeah. I mean, I don't know. I feel like Vince was disgruntled. Or no, he might not have been the Vince Carter one. He might have. This was, might have been on his hiatus for a few years.
Right. Yeah, this was, Carter was traded in December of 2004.
Yeah. So he was, Rod Thorne had left earlier that season to kind of go, he had left earlier that season to work for the league, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Memory serves me right. But yeah, I mean, it definitely set the Nets up to, and then Vince Carter trade was, we can get into that, but that was one. It was kind of a, I'd say, low risk, very high reward, because you're giving up basically some role players and Alonzo Mourning, who already hated the Nets anyway, or VC.
Yeah, and they gave up a couple draft picks, but and as we would later learn, those can be very valuable. But they wind up not biting the Nets in the butt in this particular trade. But yeah, during the regular season, the Nets go 52-30. They double their win total from the previous season when they won 26 games. It was the first 50-win season in franchise history. Jason Kidd, second MVP voting in the season. He averaged 10 assists per game, just under 10 assists per game, second in the league to Andre Miller. He was over 7 rebounds a game, first among point guards, 2.1 steals per game, third in the league behind Iverson and Ron Artest. He just kind of did a little bit of everything, and that Princeton offense allowed the Nets to have like a really balanced scoring load because of all the motion and the cutting, and it kind of really emphasizes passing as opposed to one-on-one isolation play, which you might find more in the triangle, ironically enough, that the Nets would go up against in the finals. But for New Jersey, they had no one who averaged 15 points a game in this season, which is like mind-boggling.
Yeah, that was absolutely crazy to me, that let alone that any team had that, let alone made it to the finals. And I mean, I think your point about getting some discipline in the half-court offense is really important, because this really wasn't a good half-court offense team. They were so good in transition, and that's where they really kind of made their money, when Jason Kidd was able to run with all these athletes. And it's such an important part of him being a great rebounder and kind of, I'd say, paving the trail for guys like Westbrook nowadays, AC, because he would just get the rebound and go. Obviously, besides Jason Collins, you have a ton of athletes alongside him, like a Kerry Kittles, Kmart, Van Horn, Richard Jefferson, big Aaron Williams. So this was a really interesting team. And also, I think you kind of touched on it, but Kidd averaging 2 more rebounds than Kmart. I think that was just a really shocking stat as well.
Yeah, Kidd he literally did everything. It was insane. He averaged 14.7 points. Kmart led the team in scoring at 14.9. Van Horn was 14.8. And then Kittles was 13.4. So they were all within a point and a half of each other. So it was really like any given night during the regular season, you didn't really know what to prepare for if you were the opposing team's defense. And that kind of allows you to like sneak up to wins. And then in the playoffs, it was really their defense, which allowed them to succeed. They were first in the NBA in defensive rating throughout the season, compared to just 17th in offensive rating. So it was really at a time in the NBA where teams weren't exactly like flying up and down the court. The Nets tried to kind of do that. They were ninth in pace because that was really like their only, or like their best offense, I would say.
Yeah, no, for sure. And I think, like, I can't believe a team that was 17th in offensive rating got to the finals. That's shocking. But also, the year before, they were 23rd in defense and went from 23rd to first in 1 year. And doing it by playing a couple of rookies, you know, Jason Collins, Richard Jefferson. Kmart was only in his second year, but I think between him and his athleticism, being able to cover for a lot of guys, and just Kidd, I mean, having someone at the point of attack that could be so dynamic defensively as a ball hawk, someone with size as well, and him, having him replace Marbury. I mean, to go from 23rd to first in defense in a year is crazy, because it's something that's usually instilled by the culture, and to basically have an entire new team of players come in and make that impact was really interesting.
Yeah, Kidd himself kind of like was the new culture. He was first team all defense, first team all NBA. Like he really was New Jersey's like first real star in a long time, like probably since Dr. J, like back in the ABA days.
So that's going to do it for today's episode. We're trying out a new posting schedule. So we'll have part two of this podcast tomorrow and then part three on Sunday. In the meantime, if you want even more Locked On podcast content to listen to, try the new Chad Ford's NBA Big Board podcast. They just redid, or are redrafting rather, the 2016 NBA draft. So definitely listen to that to find out where guys like Caris LeVert would go if Chad was redoing the draft today. And until tomorrow, be well. Bye.